Here's the poll. Okay, well, we've already ruined the quiz on what this, figuring out what this is. But this is really in the front of my slide just to remind me to thank Tom, Devitt, and Rob Doyle, who gave me a bunch of cool animal shots, none of which are mine, at the beginning. And I also like to get my credits out of the way at the beginning, because otherwise I have a tendency to forget them. Most of this work is based on a paper called Case for Evolutionary Genomics and Genomic Biodiversity that I did with Jonathan Eisen at Tiger, Norman Doggett in the genomics group at Los Alamos National Laboratories, and Michael Cummings at the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole. I'll also be talking about a little bit of work I did with Bill Bruno, who's also at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and some other work by Mike Cummings, and a little bit of work I did earlier with Nick Goldman at Cambridge University and Willie Taylor at the Mill Hill National Laboratory over in the United Kingdom. So, now I've thrown a couple of good buzzwords at you, evolutionary genomics and genomic biodiversity. I'm going to start out the talk by just defining what I mean by that, since you could probably define them in many, many different ways. But by evolutionary genomics, I simply mean the application of large-scale genomic technology and strategies in molecular evolution. And when I say genomic biodiversity, I mean the intense sampling of organisms at different taxonomic levels for large genomes or genomic regions. And I call it genomic biodiversity to distinguish it in particular from genomic diversity, which is often used to talk about the intraspecific variation, particularly within humans. Now, evolutionary genomics is very similar, obviously, to comparative genomics, which is just doing comparative analysis on different genomes. And, of course, it could be considered a subsidiary of functional genomics, defined broadly as the overall effort to figure out what the heck all those genes we just got are doing, how they interact with each other and such. So what I'm going to talk about today is the justification of evolutionary genomics and genomic diversity on a large scale, possible opportunities for increased efficiency in interaction with genome centers, and then a little project we're doing and trying to promote, which is the vertebrate mitochondria project, and I'll explain that in greater detail in a few moments. So, why do evolutionary genomics and genomic biodiversity at all? Well, there's a number of different subcomponents to that. That is, you can improve phylogenetic analysis, look at molecular evolution, population genetics, which I'm not really going to talk about, but then I have in big bold letters functional genomics. I think this is the most compelling argument for it. That is, everybody's extremely interested in what the heck all these genes are doing, and so what can genomic biodiversity analyses say for that, for functional genomics? And now, of course, these are a bit of arbitrary segregations of a large number of fields, and a lot of these have interactions. That is, phylogenetics has things to say about molecular evolution and vice versa that we'll talk about. Population genetics has an interaction with molecular evolution, and they all lead to possibilities of considering information about functional genomics. So, first off then, what are the kinds of features we might expect of a genome-based strategy? Talking about multiple genes, sequencing multiple genes and taxa simultaneously, large-scale coordinated multi-group efforts, shotgun, high-throughput, high-redundancy. Okay, so just a lot of basically the point of these sorts of methods is to shift the cost from labor to automated equipment. We don't think about it during the genome process. We just let the machines do most of it. That leads to high efficiency, and saves human researchers from doing a lot of tedious, laborious work, and they can focus on scientific design and analysis. The primary products of such a thing will be, of course, complete sequencing of large regions from many taxa, more accurate phylogenetic reconstruction, I'll talk about that more in a minute, better estimation of evolutionary processes. We can, by estimating the by getting these better estimates of evolutionary process, that also means we're going to be able to get better estimates of changes in the evolutionary process, be able to link sequence evolution to features of structure and function better and improve the accuracy of functional genomics predictions. So that first point, better phylogenetic analysis, what are we talking about? First off, we can get better estimation of the evolutionary models. Many of us have been talking about this sort of thing over the last few days, but with higher and higher taxon density sampling, you can get more and more information about what's going on and the changes. And I'll try to demonstrate in a minute that by getting better estimates of these models, we can get better reconstruction of topological relationships. And then also another thing people are interested in, better estimate of divergence times to position when different things diverge from each other. For example, what's the origin of humans? What's the origin of primates? What's the origin of vertebrates and that sort of thing? So this slide is just a little reminder slide. This is not my own work. This is work by Michael Cummings, Sally Otto, and John Wakely from some time ago. But this is just to remind everybody that if we're looking at the percent, the fraction of the correct tree that can be reconstructed, and then we look, we see how many nucleotides we use, you get better and better estimates of a topology by adding nucleotides. Okay, somewhat obvious. This was just a study that was done actually with mitochondrial genomes, and they were subsampling. They're taking as correct a fairly uncontroversial taxonomy of about 11 taxa that basically everybody might believe in, and then subsampling up to about half of the mitochondrial genome. And what you can see there, just a couple of points about it. Obviously, subsampling, eventually you're going to go up to one because you get that answer with the complete mitochondrial genome, and they knew that from the start. But you also see that, say, with 1,000 or 2,000 nucleotides, you don't get the right answer all that often, as low as say, 25%. What's that? Well, it's random sampling. What do you mean it depends which? Well, yeah, that we'll get onto that. There are ways of considering which genes and whatever. This is random sampling over this entire genome. Okay, so it's not a knowledge basis assessment of that. But you're absolutely right about that, and we'll be making that point in just a moment. So the next point that has to do with what Paul is talking about is a little study we did really to show exactly that. That is, if we can figure out how well can we figure out what the molecular evolutionary model does, and then how much does that improve our ability to reconstruct phylogenies. So the model we used here, again, this is the work with Bill Bruno, is extremely simple. So we're talking about taking this four taxon unrooted tree, okay, and we're asking the question, how well do we reconstruct that central node, which is a very short branch and therefore somewhat difficult to reconstruct. Then when we add taxa, we add branches, we're adding them evenly halfway down each branch, so we're getting a very evenly branched tree. And again, we're still asking always that question, how well do we reconstruct that innermost branch? Okay. Now the model we're using is also extremely simple, about as simple as you can get. It's a two-state model, equal frequencies, and the only complication to it is that we also have two rates. That is, we have two sets of site classes that are going at two different rates, about ninefold different from one another.
So when you say that you get that node, you're saying that you correctly partition the states from everything to the left and everything to the right.
I'm saying we use a phylogenetic reconstruction technique, and we say what percentage of the time do we infer this tree structure according to whatever optimality criteria we're using.
But I mean, for instance, if things that if you were to do things randomly, the probability of getting that right
is one third.
Increase sharply with the number of taxon, because if one taxon is all.
Yes, it is. That's why we're avoiding. So when we add taxa,
yeah,
right, we're not asking how well do we get the whole percent. How often do we get the whole tree right? Because if we did that, our probability of getting it right would depend on the number of taxa, right? So we're taking care to always ask the same question, which is how well do we get those original four taxa right? but then we're adding the extra tax and asking how does that affect the problem. Yeah. By the way, too, anytime, I mean, I know everybody does anyway, but if anything's unclear at any time, please feel free to ask questions. I know sometimes I tend to talk a little bit fast. Anyway, so this is the first result then. We're looking at in the improvement in the phylogenetic reconstruction. Just to orient you on the graph, okay, so on this axis we have the percent correct innermost node, that is how often we reconstructed that node I showed in the previous graph. And on this axis we have three cases. One is the four taxon case, okay, and on the right is the eight taxon case I just showed you. And just for comparison, in the middle is the four taxon case with twice the sequence length. Okay, and that's just for comparison. So what we're looking at then is if you double the amount of sequence, you can do it in two ways, either by doubling the sequence length or by doubling the number of taxa. How much better do you do? We use four reconstruction techniques, and I'm going to take a moment here to explain what these are. The first is parsimony. People have talked about that enough already that I don't think I need to reiterate it, but it's mostly used as a control. That is, it's a sort of not exactly model-free method, but this sort of very simplified model assumption. And then I use three different maximum likelihood techniques. So the first, equal rates maximum likelihood, I use as sort of a negative control. This is a model that assumes there's only one rate of evolution going on among all these sites. Okay, so it can never take into account the differences in rate variation. Okay? Now this SSML is a site-specified maximum likelihood model, and I take that as my positive control. So for various reasons, I knew ahead of time that was going to be a positive control, and that's where I say ahead of time, this is, each site has its category specified. I don't tell it what the relative rates are, but I say this is, each site is in one category or the other, and I tell it correctly what category it's in. So this is basically, this is the potential of the data, okay? That is a reconstruction technique. If it knew everything, ought to be able to do this well. But oftentimes... What's that?
Did you use a gamma distribution to synthesize the data?
No, this is not a gamma distribution. This is a two-rate simulation, and now I'm doing a two-rate, two-class model where the rates are correctly specified, okay? So there's no gamma about it. All this model has to do is figure out what the relative rates are and then figure out the topology. Now, the third model then is exactly what Richard's talking about. This is a gamma model. Because it's two states, it's basically a very simplified hidden Markov model where we don't know what rate category any site is in, okay? But we sum over the possibility that each site is in one rate category or another, okay? And that's basically the common model that people use when they're reconstructing phylogenies. And the reason for this is, of course, I mean, obviously you would use the site-specified model if you knew correctly what each category everything is in, but you have to ask yourself the question, do you know correctly ahead of time what each category is in? That is, what each rate category a site is in. Now you can do something like say, okay, this is an alpha helix in this particular situation, or this is the first codon, second codon, third codon position, but you actually still don't know that those aren't mixed rate categories. Okay, so we have to assume that in general you're not really going to know ahead of time, so we're asking the question, how well can you figure it out? And what you see from this is, first off, everything is going up. It's slightly better in every case to add sequence data by adding taxa. Okay, but what's interesting about this is basically at four taxon, these other three models do equally well. Double the sequence length, they do equally well. And with eight taxa, they do equally well. And none of these, particularly surprising to me, was the gamma model, are doing any better at reconstructing that particular phylogenetic question. Now, this is particularly surprising in that by the time you get to eight taxa, the global parameters of the model are very well specified. Okay, so it's not a problem of the model. It's not a problem of understanding the model. Most people in this situation, I think, would have assumed that gamma was going to do quite well at reconstructing the phylogeny. But clearly, there's a lot of potential. It's doing no better than parsimony. That's of concern. So, yeah.
The difference between the EML and the GML on the eight classification, what's the difference?
No, not at all. So no, these are essentially flat, these three lower bars. Okay, so we wanted to get at the why is this happening and how can this be corrected? And the way we did this is a sort of cute technique we thought up called Doppelganger trees, which if you know any German, there's probably some German here that could give me a whole thesis on it, but basically these are shadow-like doubles. Okay, so what we do here, the reason we call them doppelgangers, is because we make shadow-like doubles of the original sequence data set. That is, what we do is we evolve sequence data sets that are evolved along identical trees, but entirely independent of the sequence data set we're interested in. Okay, and that's equivalent to having multiple trees that are connected by branches of infinite length. Okay, and the reason we do this is because when you add taxa to a phylogeny, you're doing two things, right? One is that as you add taxa, you're getting better and better inferences about the state at the nodes which surround the branch of interest. Okay, and the other is that you're getting better information about the model in some way. Okay, and we wanted to separate those two effects out and find out, well, what's happening in terms of how well we reconstruct and why we reconstruct. So we set up this simple model to do this. By adding these doppelganger trees, we're adding absolutely no information about the internal states at any of these nodes in this tree of interest, this focus tree. But we do have the potential for adding information about the rates, and in particular the rate classes that things are going on. Now, these are the results. These are exactly the same situation as I showed you in the previous slide. This 8 taxon situation, in fact, is the same set of numbers from that previous slide. And a couple of points first off. It's very comforting. Equal rates maximum likelihood is absolutely unfazed by adding these doppelganger trees. Okay, that's good. How could it get more information about the rate variation when it doesn't take into account rate variation, but it's unaffected? Same with the site-specified model. It's basically not doing any better. That's because it's already doing as well as it can. The model's extremely well specified. The rate ratios are well specified. It's doing extremely well at the reconstruction. A point of interest here is the parsimony technique. This is a bit unexpected. We weren't trying to show this, but it basically has what we would call pathological problems with these doppelganger trees, as opposed to site-specified, or as opposed to the equal rates thing, which is unaffected. It has wild fluctuations. I take this to mean that there's a problem many studies that have done and looked at taxon addition in the past have avoided likelihood, because it's very hard to resimulate likelihood and redo likelihood analyses over and over and over because they're time consuming. So they basically will often do them using parsimony. And I think very often people get incorrect inferences using that. So basically you should probably view any study that looks at taxon addition with parsimony with a great deal of skepticism based on this. But the most interesting point about this, okay, is what is happening to the gamma model. Okay, and that is as we add these doppelganger trees, the gamma model is doing better and better, and is in fact approaching the utility of that site-specified model. And what's happening here, how this can be viewed as, is as you add these doppelganger trees, you're adding more information about how each individual site is evolving. And you can look at the posterior probability, that is, if you calculate the posterior probability that one site is in one class or another, as the gamma model is getting better and better, the posterior probability of a site being in one class or the other is approaching one. Yes?
I don't understand the parsimony result at all. Does the parsimony that the 8 taxon tree know about the doppelganger trees when you are doing the parsimony analysis?
They're, okay, so it's in the analysis.
Right.
right? That you're reconstructing, you're reconstructing this, these entire tree sets. In fact, in this case, I'm setting the structure of those doppelganger trees for the likelihood model. I'm setting the structure of those. But in general, basically, it's reconstructing this entire relationship. Okay, and so then, but the question that I'm asking is within that entire topology, how well was the was that relationship of interest determined? So I'm basically ignoring the rest of the topology, right? Yeah.
I think I have missed something important, which is what the point of the doppelganger is. So if you want 24 tracks in there, that's three knots of eight.
Yeah.
Well, why not have 24 real ones? What's the difference between 24 real ones and three knots of eight?
Okay, so the difference, if you're talking about adding taxa within the particular tree of interest, right? You're talking about adding taxa that are closely related to the question you're asking, right? If you do that, you're adding information about the states of the internal nodes, right? So it's simply that there's two, basically, if you're adding closely related taxa, there's two effects going on. One is that you're adding information about what the state of internal nodes are, and the other is that you're adding information about what the rates at each site are. I wanted to separate out those effects. So by adding those doppelganger trees, right, this is a relationship. These are essentially branches of infinite length. That means when the information comes in here, it's essentially random. Okay, so it can't be added. There's no way to add information about these internal nodes. So that's the point, is I'm separating out that factor.
If that's what you mentioned about the variation in
the length of the sun. Yeah, the point isn't that I wouldn't get that I'm getting better information by doing the doppelganger trees than I would if I added them within this tree. In fact, I probably would get better information if I added them within this tree. The point is simply I wanted to ask by with the adding taxa, right? I just wanted to ask. I wanted to separate out those two possible effects. So in fact, if you added them within here, you'd be doing two things. You'd be adding information about the rates, and you'd be adding information about the internal nodes, but you wouldn't have any means of separating out those two effects. So this is a means of separating them out. Rather, I'm not trying to suggest that anybody should add, try to find extremely divergent trees. Right? I mean, these are so divergent you won't be able to align them. This is not a real thing. It's a simulation so that I can study an effect, not a recommendation. No, obviously you would add things nearby, but it's also clear that, for example, some people have said that if you have a tree with nodes of interest, that you should never add taxa outside that tree of interest. Okay, and that's not true. That's an artifact of parsimony. That's an artifact of doing parsimony analysis.
So
Yes, I'm eliminating that factor because I just want to address this, the one question about the effect on rates.
Can you explain a little bit more, how do you add information on the array?
Okay, so these are basically what I'm doing is I'm getting an alignment which now has 24 taxa. So each site has a consistent, each site is in a consistent rate category. Okay. And that means that there's a consistency of the rate category of each site between these doppelganger trees, but that's the only information. Okay, and
rate is concerned, these sites are different.
As far as rate is concerned?
Well, okay, the topology of these three copies are exactly the same.
Yes, that's right.
But they are different sites when you look at rate, is that right?
No, they have the sites that are in the same alignment have the same rate category.
Oh, but now you have 24. You have a longer column, is that right?
Yeah, I have up to three times the density of sequences in the column.
So you have better sampling of the statistics, or you have better statistics, is that what it is, or better averaging?
Why is it happening? I'm getting essentially what's happening is that I'm getting a better posterior probability that each site is in a one category or the other by adding these extra. So by adding these doppelganger trees, I get a better posterior estimate of being in one site or the other. So you can view it, if the posterior probability of being in one category or another is one, right, then I basically, that's my site-specified model. But I'm asking the question, how well can the data, essentially I'm saying, how well can the data determine that site-specified information? How well can it do the site specification? How fast can we get that information out of the data set? And the motivation here is essentially to say that we can get better and better estimates of the model by adding taxonomic, by adding sequence biodiversity. That's the main motivation, and we do get better estimates of the model, but it's not just the global parameters of the model that are important. That is, at a point where the global parameters are extremely well specified, we still can't do better until we get the individual sites correctly specified. Yeah.
I'm still trying to understand the parsimony. Is this
why bother? This is like
I agree. So is this basically is the pathology basically based on a long branch attraction and some
the pathology is based on the fact that parsimony cannot take into account branch lengths. Okay. So a likelihood with likelihood you're getting essentially a lot of probability that these branches are extremely long, therefore likelihood is expecting no information coming into this branch, right? Whereas with parsimony, it doesn't take into account branch lengths, so it's going to take essentially these estimates of the interior nodes, it's going to take them as equivalent to information from any other taxon, and it messes it up.
Got it. So it doesn't make the changes, doesn't encourage the changes to cluster together.
No, I've done this, I've set this system up particularly, I should add, I've set this up particularly to avoid a problem called long branch attraction. It's been mentioned before, but I wanted to keep long branch attraction out of this. Okay, now it's known that if you understand the model better, that you will avoid long branch attraction. That is, if you can build a better model, then long branch attraction is not nearly as much a problem as it is with parsimony. This is saying that you add taxa, you get a better estimate of the model, therefore you're going to avoid long branch attraction. But again, in this study, this was a factor that I wanted to rule out, and that's why these trees are all entirely symmetric with even branch lengths, except for that central branch. Yes?
Is that some way dependent on the differences two models, the rate models? If you made these two rate models more different from each other, would the gamma maximum likelihood model
start to do better?
Start to do a lot significantly.
Presumably, eventually it might. I mean, at some point, I didn't explore. I mean, there's a lot of space you could explore. I didn't explore out the entire system of the space. But I mean, yeah, at some point you might expect that it's going to start to do better. This is a nine-fold rate difference. Okay, so this is actually a fairly large rate difference already. I expected gamma. I'll tell you, when I set the study up, when I first saw that slide, I'm like, I just want to say, okay, gamma's going to do better. And it's like, whoa, what's going on here?
He's essentially saying that the gamma model is just like flipping a coin on each side.
It's saying the gamma model, if it can't tell what category each side is in, yeah, it's basically flipping a coin and you're not getting much extra information. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, Paul.
Because it's just too constrained, the gamma. Because if you've got two very different categories,
yeah.
Gamma does better at fitting a continuous range. I
should explain here. When I say gamma, the way gamma is usually done is it categorizes the gamma distribution into rate categories. Okay, so because if you do a continuous gamma, you can never do these calculations. They take far too long. So normally people do them into 2, 4, 8, 6, or whatever categories until there's enough categories that they think they're not getting a better answer. In this case, I've only got two rate categories. If you ran that kind of simulation, you'd say, if you ran the gamma on this, you'd go to two categories, and then you'd try three categories, and you'd say, I don't get any better of an answer, I may as well stick with two categories. With two categories of the gamma, then we're basically just talking about a two-category model. So the gamma's, I mean, it's sort of irrelevant to call it a gamma, except that that is in fact how I did it. But it's basically, you've just got two rate categories, and it's figuring out the rate ratio of those two categories. What's that?
Are they independent?
The rate categories, yes. I mean, you can, with two categories, you can just change the alpha, the shape parameter of the gamma to get any relative ratio of those two categories you want. So it's just, it's optimizing the same thing, right? The gamma, that alpha parameter can be, you know, just a quick calculation, and you can get the rate ratio, right? So it's just, it's the same thing, but the site-specified model is doing the same thing. It's estimating a rate ratio. The gamma model is also estimating a rate ratio, essentially. It just doesn't know what category each site is in. Yeah?
Another sort of part of the parameters which people are having more different types of sites. So if you had, if instead of having two rates, you had four rates.
You could. Yeah, the point of this isn't to say two rates is better or something like that. The point is to do a very simple generalization. This is going to generalize, okay? The point is to say this could go for multiple rates, protein evolution. I'm interested in studying protein evolution. Okay, so I mean, I think this is going to generalize. The exact number of taxa, I don't know. With protein evolution, more states, more rates, you're going to need more taxa. I can just about guarantee that to get good answers, right? But in principle, it's going to hold. If we want this kind of information, we need a lot more sequence biodiversity. Yeah? So let's try moving on. This is actually a little bit of a diversion in here, but I thought I'd throw it up here because everybody's mathematically interested. And also to prepare you, again, for Arnold Kluge's visit next week. which is just simply to show what I'm doing here now. This is a single rate among sites, okay? And I'm just asking the question, when you add taxa, right, what does better, okay? And what you see here, this bottom line is with four taxa, and there's I've only shown one of them. I'm going to show the equal rates model, maximum likelihood model, because with four taxa, everything does the same. Parsimony does just as well. But what's interesting about this is when you go to eight taxa, there's this sort of zone of inefficiency of parsimony. That is, these open circles show parsimony, and they show that there's this complete zone where it really doesn't do as well as maximum likelihood at getting the correct answer. And what's interesting about this is that this is a situation where people might expect parsimony to do well. That is, again, there's no long branch attraction going on here. Okay, you're adding taxonomic density. Most people would have considered a priori that's going to do better, that parsimony is going to make better and better use, and it's going to actually get closer to the efficiency of maximum likelihood. And in this case, it doesn't. And this was actually just in response to another paper. But in this case, it's clear that with likelihood, it's much better to add taxa. And part of the reason I did this study is that when I did it with two rates, it was sort of somewhat interesting is that I got different results than a previously published study that did things in a very similar way. And what's actually interesting is that the mean rate here, 0.5, was the mean rate in the other studies. And when you have mixed rates, parsimony sort of takes on rather than taking on the average behavior, right, it takes on the behavior of the endpoints. That is, it does, just with eight taxa, it does just about as well as likelihood when you have a mixed rate model, but when you have a single rate model, it does considerably worse. Just an interesting little statistical point. Any quick questions on that? Let's zip on then. The previous was basically an argument about adding taxon biodiversity and our ability to get better estimates of molecular evolutionary models, specifically site-specified models. And this is some other work I did, I'll just talk about pretty briefly, which is looking at coevolution between amino acid residues in proteins. When I say coevolution, what I'm talking about, these are two examples of, say, negative and positive coevolution. Well, we're looking at, say, two amino acid residues. Let's say one's big and one's small. And then over evolutionary time, there's a probability that they might change together. That is, big goes to small and small goes to big. That would be negative coevolution. Positive coevolution is the opposite. But when I say coevolution, I'm trying to distinguish it here from things that people call correlated variation or correlated mutation, because a lot of times what people do is they're looking at alignments. Okay, so you're looking at alignments and you're looking at correlations between states in an alignment. And what I'm talking, in the study that we did, what we're looking at is the probability that one site, that is the state at one site, will affect the probability of substitution at a second site, right? So real coevolution, what's the interactive probability of evolution? Now, when you want to look at coevolution in a protein, you don't generally know ahead of time what things are paired with what. So like in Paul's work, you're looking at RNA, right? You know ahead of time it's in a helix and you know these two things are paired, so you're looking at coevolution, you know what matches with what. In the proteins, it's a completely unknown matching process, so we're trying to do a huge number of pairwise comparisons and pull things out. And in addition, we generally don't have really huge data sets to deal with, so we don't necessarily have enough information to get the what actually is going on in the evolution each site in a really detailed way. So what I did in this is I said, let's try to find a robust method to detect coevolution. And the principle that I decided on was that if coevolution is occurring between two sites, that it's likely that there's a major axis of coevolution. Right? That is, there's either pairs of sites or clusters of amino acids that are tending to coevolve, and that maybe other coevolutionary interactions are not going to be as large. Okay, and if there is a principal axis, we can maybe detect that more robustly. So what I did was set up this method of basically clustering amino acids in any way you want at a particular site into two groups. Yes? It really could be anything you like. I'm assuming simply that there may be a major axis. I mean, basically you've got 20 amino acids. They've got all sorts of physical chemical properties that you could measure. It's been shown previously that we generally, the biochemists don't appreciate physical chemical properties in the same way nature does. So I'm actually not presuming to know what the properties of the amino acids that ought to develop these axes are. However, what you can look at is, for example, you might pick a physical chemical vector like charge or size, which is what I did in this case, and then use that to cluster and hope that that corresponded to whatever that axis of coevolution was. Try to make of it what you will after you're done. So what we did then is we set up a likelihood model. So we set up two models, one where we have independent evolution of the sites, and then we have a second model where the sites are evolving in a dependent fashion. Okay? And we have one parameter in that model. The degree of freedom difference can actually be visualized as a particular parameter I call residue disequilibrium, which is either negative or positive, and that corresponds to what I showed on the previous slide, negative or positive coevolution. Now in this slide, what I'm showing you then is sort of a reverse cumulative distribution. This right side is just an expansion of the left graph, of the complete graph. And what I'm just showing you as you move to the right is what's the probability of likelihood ratios that are to the right of a particular point. And so the reason to show it this way is it's very convenient, is you get your probability cutoffs, which I've shown here at the 5% and 2.5% level in green, and then you can read them off and say, okay, this likelihood ratio is significant or not. Now, I set this up so that this likelihood ratio, these two models, this independent and dependent evolution, were nested models with one degree of freedom. Now, the usual convenience in such a situation is to assume that the chi-squared distribution, that the distribution of the likelihood ratio will be distributed as chi-squared with one degree of freedom. And that's this bottom black line. So what we showed about 2.5 years ago is that that assumption is extremely bad. And what you need to do is parametric bootstrapping in order to get a reasonable estimation of the likelihood ratio distribution, which is this orange line. Okay, now the other two lines that I'm showing you, the blue line is positive coevolution, and this red line is negative coevolution according to charge. And this is just to show you that in this case, we actually have a protein that we actually can detect something real in a protein. That is, there's this large excess of negatively coevolving sites here, and this is extremely significant that something's going on here. We found a number of different cases with significant coevolution. But this is really the best case in that we're talking about sites that are separated by less than 5 amino acids along the linear sequence. Okay, so it's a smaller number, and we can say for each of those that is beyond the 0.05 level in this case, each of those sites has a 75% probability of actually having co-evolved rather than just being due to chance. Okay, so the posterior probability is 0.75 for each of these pairs we're looking at. And what I'm showing you here is that this actually makes sense in terms of the biochemical structure. So if we segregate these out in terms of the distance separation along the linear sequence, okay, first off we have, this is the distribution, these are the number of pairs that are separated, variable pairs that are separated by that distance. And this is just to show you there's not a problem with the amphipathic helix. So normally you would expect with a alpha helix, if it's amphipathic, you might expect some degree of correlation in terms of the pairs. This is the amount of difference. It's not significantly different between the separations. Nevertheless, it's taken into account. And what we see is that for those things with a likelihood ratio in excess beyond the 0.05 level, we have a very large excess at distances of 3 and 4. Okay, now there's 3.6 residues per turn of the alpha helix. So what they're talking about here is that the helix is going up, that those residues that are stacked on top of each other in the alpha helix are tending to co-evolve. Okay, now in this case there's some tendency for these things obviously to be on the surface and to be at the ends of buried alpha helices. Also, though, at this point we're getting to the point of something that's not really statistically significant. We found a number of other cases of coevolution that were interesting. Again, this is the strongest. But one of the more interesting things is that we found that there's a lot of coevolution of charge at the surface of proteins. Okay, they were segregated out at the surface. And there's also that segregated in that there's an excess of charge coevolution of adjacent pairs on the surface. And interestingly enough, there's also coevolution of charge pairs at opposite ends of the protein, which is probably due to either maintenance of a dipole moment or some sort of folding interaction or avoidance of quaternary structure. Okay. This is just a quick slide to show one of these examples of what the coevolution would look like in one of these cases, but this is just where we have the positive charge being replaced in these two different pairs.
If you just look at the distribution of distances in the myoglobin, for things that have a significant coevolution versus things that don't. Is there any sense at all of how biased it is towards things that are local?
Yeah, there is a sense. I mean, you can do it in different ways. It's kind of interesting. In terms of size, you get actually a very strong bias towards positive coevolution. That is, you have a significant number of more positively coevolving sites than negatively coevolving sites. Okay, but as you try to look at the more significant level, that becomes less and less significant. So what I believe is going on is, in fact, coevolution is occurring in a regular process in proteins, but it's the paralyzed interactions, any coevolution is distributed among many sites. So there's actually, the way I view this is, among many sites, the way I view this is that there's a somewhat of a tendency, if you imagine, like, for example, two alpha helices that are adjacent to one another, right? There's a tendency for them to separate together, and you're going to get expansion, you're going to get a localized expansion at a reasonably large distance. I looked at actually quite a number of ways, that kind of thing, looking at different distributions and distances and things. There's a number of things that are significant. A lot of them are of that category. That is, weak coevolution is probably distributed among a number of sites, and that's why partly in the past, people have had problems detecting coevolution, A, because it is distributed, and B, because if you, but we've, I said with the paper with Willie Taylor, if you just look at it with an alignment and you don't take phylogenetic relationships into account while you're building your statistic, you can, then you're getting a lot of noise from the phylogenetic structure in the coevolutionary statistics, so that noise is just overwhelming any signal that you might hope to find. So the problem with that is again, I mean, I got frustrated soon after I did this in the lack of data sets that are available for this kind of thing. You need a lot of, you need a large numbers of taxa to look at these kinds of questions in with any degree of accuracy. And then also, if you're interested in looking at interactions of proteins, which is very important in functional genomics, you need the same sets of taxa between two different proteins. So large data sets with the same sets of taxa are actually rarer than you might hope. And then I'm going to show you in a minute another problem in terms of the ideal data set. So in evolutionary structural and functional genomics, we want a better knowledge of the evolutionary process. We can start to answer questions then, because of that knowledge of the process, how does structure and function affect rates and probabilities of substitution? Actually, Richard Goldstein here, sort of one of the pioneers in developing some of these models with protein substitution, that is, site-specified models of protein substitution, where the rates, the substitution matrix at an individual site arises from the data rather than being pre-specified, as it is most of the time. So as we get more biodiversity, we're going to get better and better ability to make those kinds of estimate. We can look at changes in the evolutionary process with changes in function, and therefore perhaps be able to predict changes in function, which I know Andreas would argue with me, but I would argue that changes in function are going to tend to happen on a rapidly after a gene duplication. And then you also can have changes in the evolutionary process with change in structure. That is, as structure changes, the context of individual sites is going to change. And that's going to probably happen slowly. That is, the changes in structure happen much more slowly than changes in sequences. And then hopefully, as we get better estimates, we can begin to predict structure and functional features. This is another point I want to make, though, about the kind of data set we want to get, is that, again, structure evolves slowly. So if you compare a chicken and a turkey lysozyme, for example, you don't see very many differences in their tertiary and secondary structure. Humans, even going to humans, you don't see that many differences. But as you go to a really big jump to a phage T4, you can hardly tell that these things actually are homologous unless you do a lot of very careful alignments and a bunch of statistics on it. These are, in fact, all lysozymes. These are homologous. But what's happening as protein evolution moves along is it evolves slowly like an onion. That is, it evolves from the end layers somewhat as from the outside in. So you get rapid evolutionary, you get rapid changes as outside, and then over deeper and deeper divergence times, you tend to get more and more changes in structure as you go more towards the core of the protein. Okay, but as those changes are occurring, right, that means that the context of any coevolutionary interactions are going to be changing over that time period. So if we really want to understand the coevolutionary process, we need higher densities of sequences that are actually more closely related than, for example, a wide diversity of bacteria, which is your usual data set that you get in this day and age. And I want to liken what I'm talking about here, this little simile. But if you're trying to get a view of a landscape, right, if you build PAM matrices, this is a bit like sort of the distant view. That is, everything appears to be in focus from that distance. You get nice estimates of the probability of change between these amino acids. But in a PAM matrix, you're averaging over all these different sites, all these different proteins, all these different things. And the problem is that different things may be going on. So if you actually want to get a good estimate of what's going on close at your feet, right, you have to focus in close to your feet. And when you do that, the more distant landscape is going to get a lot blurrier. But you need that. You want what I'm saying basically is you need this close-up distance to understand what's originally happening in the evolutionary process. And this is why I'm sort of promoting this vertebrate mitochondria project, a bit of a pilot project, to focus on what I call the near-human evolutionary environment. And this is my description of what the near-human evolutionary environment is. And I'll leave it to Dr. Higgs here to identify all these different taxa. Quickly, can you say what the... How many of these can we all identify with? Gecko. Bird. Fish, yellowfin tuna. So anyway, what I believe is if we really want to understand what's going on in the short-term evolutionary process and be able to use that for prediction, so particularly if we want to understand interactions between proteins, we have to look at an evolutionary environment that's close enough that those surface changes, which are happening quickly, haven't changed too much. Okay, so we need to focus on more of this sort of scale. And this project that I'm talking about is basically, we're talking about simultaneous automated shotgun sequencing of mitochondrial genomes as a demonstration of these principles, and trying to build a data set that we can look at and develop our analytical techniques. We're talking about mixing 10 to 20 genomes per experiment, which is sort of the heretical part of it, and I'll go over the protocol in a moment. Sort of keeps, you know, saying 2002 genomes. I'd like to see 2002 genomes in the database by the end of 2002. That might have been a little over-optimistic, so now I'll say 2003 genomes by the end of 2003, since I made this slide a while ago. But anyway, the point really is more, we need these kinds of, we want to try to get these kinds of numbers up to get I think that we're going to be able to get a qualitative difference in our ability to understand the protein evolutionary process. And in terms of density of sampling, we're talking about that some groups will be heavily sampled within the vertebrates. For example, mammals, primates, perhaps passerines and rodents, perhaps snakes, such that we can focus in and get a really good estimate. In case there are some sites that are evolving very, very quickly, we can get good estimates of those, and then we can get good estimates of those that are evolving slightly more slowly by looking across the entire vertebrate sets. And we can also do comparative analysis of evolutionary rates between these different sort of focused data sets. Running out of time a little bit here, but the reason to look at the human mitochondria, just sort of review for some people, maybe not for others, but it's just, we're talking about the circular genome. It's about 16.5 kb, 13 protein coding genes. And what's nice, there's two major things that are nice. One is that there's no recombination within this, so we're not really worried about recombination. That is, we can get an exact phylogenetic tree for this entire genome, and it's going to be the same. The second thing is that this is all color-coded by these different complexes. So these genes are parts of large multi-subunit protein complexes that form the oxidative phosphorylation, which produces ATP needed by everybody. This is just a color-coded distribution. We have site B, which is just one subunit, up to the NADH, which has, I think, seven subunits. In the NADH complex. And the point is that some of these different subunits that are interacting within their complex, some of them are not interacting, but they're linked within the overall goal of oxidative phosphorylation. Yes? Well, let's go on to that in a second. It goes slide up. These are some slides just to show you that the structural context of a number of these complexes is known. This is cytochrome oxidase. These are the three mitochondrial encoded subunits, which are together in the functional core of this protein. But you also notice this is a transmembrane region here. So we have some sites that are going to be transmembrane region, mostly alpha helical. Some sites that are non-transmembrane region, that is in this case, the intermembrane space, but you'll see some beta sheets in there in addition to alpha helices. So different...
Crystal structure?
Yeah, that's from a crystal structure, yeah. Mm-hmm. So different structural context for these different sites. This is cytochrome BC and cytochrome B, again, at the functional core of the protein, which is the mitochondrial encoded subunit. I should add also that... Among all animals, basically, those same 13 mitochondrial subunits are encoded in the mitochondrial genome. There's all the rest of the up to 70 subunits of the mitochondria are encoded in the nuclear genome and then imported into the mitochondria. And this is, of course, one of the most beautiful enzyme systems on the planet, ATP synthase, which has a couple of subunits also encoded in the mitochondria. So before we get on to how feasible things are, this is just to go over the project flow. So what we're talking about is taking these individual samples, extracting them for purposes of getting the long PCR or purification of the mitochondrial genome. And then what the heretical part is that when we're saying, let's just mix those things together, that is, we're throwing out the linkage between the species and the genomes, throw them into a site, basically mix them together and do the cloning once, okay, and then just throw them into the standard process of genome centers. That gets us to about a back-sized amount of DNA, okay, which is a bacterial artificial chromosome, and that's the standard amount of DNA that these genome centers are used to dealing with. So by mixing them together, we clone that, we do size selection shotgun cloning, okay, all, on all genomes at once, that is, we amortize the cost across the genomes. Then we do the automated sequence, automatic assembly. Okay, so we let the computer sort it back out into circles when we're done. We get about sevenfold redundancy in the sequencing, and then we do finishing and comparative annotation. And all that we're suggesting that we do then is take those original samples and do a short PCR sequencing in order to get a species-specific sequence tag from which we can then get these assembled circles and link them back to the original species. So there's some potential problems with this, of course, inaccurate taxonomic identification, and again, as I just said, we do short PCR and sequence on the original to identify any problems. There can be errors from PCR and sequencing. Part of that can be, we're doing these to sevenfold redundancy, so in general, every site, that means that on average, every site is going to be sequenced seven times. And that's going to cover a lot of errors. And we also have sequence quality values. That is, what comes out of these things is quality values of how much, what's the probability of this site, this particular sequence being what we say it is. And as people in the Genome Project showed, that can lead to a great deal of reduced error. There's also the possibility that's known that sometimes these mitochondrial DNAs will transfer into the nucleus. Okay, and we want to avoid those situations. There's two things about this. We can do mitochondrial purification if it's a problem. Long PCR also tends to avoid that problem, is that usually we only have short segments that are transferred into the genome. And then we can also do post hoc analysis of polymorphism, that is, try to detect any irregularities to see if it's likely that we actually have non-coding sequence from the nuclear genome rather than the mitochondrial DNA.
Try to mix together from species that are far apart.
Yeah, let me show the slide. I think it'll explain that.
Also, please comment on how different the sequences are for the different mixed species.
This slide, right here. Okay, so the biggest question here is exactly what he's getting at, which is this going to work? And the biggest problem is that you might have, if you have species that are close together, you're going to tend to have sequences, stretches of identical sequences. Are those going to mess up the assembly? Okay, so this is first off a graph of looking at the distribution of identical stretches of sequences between pairs within the vertebrates. And what you see is the most distant one is of actually, I should have done this as a quiz. What's the most distant parallelized comparison? They're actually ordered. Okay, so the most distant is human versus chicken, and you see there that there's an extremely sharp fall off, right? Such that there are no stretches longer than 35 base pairs. Okay, but as we get closer and closer, we tend to get a movement of the distribution to the right until the closest on this we have the human versus gorilla and the horse versus donkey, which are these two distributions here going along. But what you'll see still is that there's an extremely sharp fall off. And I haven't shown the extreme tail of this of these, but in fact, even with these two very, very close pairs, the longest stretch of identical sequence is, I think, on the order of 160. Basically, there's four or five identical segments beyond 85 in this, but not longer than 450. Now, the usual size of a sequencing fragment is 500 base pairs, which is nice. That's much longer than that. And in addition, what we're doing in this is that we take, when we do that size segmentation originally, we're doing random fragmentation of the genome, and we're getting 2 KB chunks. Okay, and then we get a clone and we sequence off both ends. So we have the added information across a 2 KB chunk to help do, to help with the assembly and make sure things are matching up. Just before you ask a question, let me add one more thing. So this is sort of theoretically, these distributions don't appear to be much a problem. And then so we ask the question, well, does this work? And so what we did then is the obvious in silico mutagenesis experiment, that is, not mutagenesis, but the in silico experiment. We just basically did the experiment in silico. We took known mitochondrial genomes, 10 known mitochondrial genomes, we chopped them up exactly as we would have in this experiment, and then we threw them into an assembly, you know, we faked the sequence and we threw them into the assembler and saw, say, can we reassemble them? Yes, we did. We reassembled them perfectly. There were 2 gaps in those 10 genomes, which is about what you expect from chance with 7-fold redundancy. It's not a perfect replication of the sequencing process, but nevertheless, in theory, it shows that this ought to be quite doable. And that's even with taxa as close as, in that case, it was as close as the human and the gorilla thrown in there. Now, among the vertebrates, there's a huge number of taxa that you can choose from that are much, much more divergent than that. And there's also a number of repetitive segments in these genomes, which again weren't a problem in it. Now, yeah, you had a question?
Yeah, I recently looked at the genome contents with the different.
For
sequencing now, substitutions. Substitutions is around 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 3. The insertions and deletions is
10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 4. Uh-huh.
And
10
to minus
2,
it's
going
for
100
there.
It's a problem for separating out what you
from a pad or something.
I don't think that will be a problem. I mean, we're doing the experiment now, and that's obviously going to prove whether it's a problem or not. But you have to remember, too, that we've got, I mean, in addition, the one advantage that we have over this, over a normal genome project, is that we can take, you know, any segment we can take, and we can figure out where it should go in the alignment, right? You know, so there's no problems there. We also, these are most of this genome is genes, right? So we can take, do a post-hoc look at it and say, are the substitutions that we see, are any insertion deletions that we see likely to be real? And if they appear to be in places that are, for example, structurally very important, then we can go back and check them over and see if there is a problem like that. But the first thing we're going to do is get a very good estimate of the error rate, and we will double check that. But I think that's a pessimistic assessment. I'm extremely pessimistic. When people have done these kinds of cloning experiments before and done them in different ways and not seen that level of error. Yeah.
Is there an obligation to describe which seem not to be statistical?
I always forget to mention in this. This is an average. Okay, I mean if I did these, you know, one bit at a time, this would be a lot more jagged. So I smoothed these curves slightly. I think I averaged them over either 3 or 5. I forget. I should have this on the graph, but it is an average. There's quite a bit of variation. It's just a random sample. I mean, it's a. You think it's regular? Well, they're not perfectly synchronized. You're welcome to take the data and look for any regularity. I wasn't focused on that. I would hate to deny that there could be. I should also point out, I mean, the reason I started at 15 is that you look within a genome, right? The distribution of identical segments within the same genome falls off very sharply to just about 0 at around 14 or 15. Okay, so that's why I started there. So if you get further, I mean, you're starting to get to the point where you're going to get random similarities. I don't have an explanation for that. Sorry.
Maybe
this is...
Yeah, what do you expect as a third position was already, I mean, it's the easiest for you up, and if you're beyond that, and you're putting the second up the next quarter, I'm probably still the same, and the third one will put it off again.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a reasonable explanation. We could look into that, but yeah, that's possible.
What's the percent identity for human chimpanzee and for human chicken?
For which?
For more similar pair and less similar pair. What's the percent identity?
Oh, don't know that off the top of my head. Sorry.
These are actually theoretical curves. Simulated curves.
No. These are taken from real genomes.
No. I understand real genomes, but these are... Oh, so these are...
This is real data. I didn't make any of this up. Unlike most of what I've said today, I didn't make this up.
Do you check whether the shape of the curve corresponds to what you expect for, let's say, if you have two sequences that are
random?
97% identical, you'd be able to reconstruct the shape of this curve from that, right?
I didn't check it. I mean, the point of this is it wasn't to really do a theoretical analysis of this identity thing, but to really say what is reality. I mean, the point is, regardless of theoretically why these curves arise, the shape of the curve determines whether they're problems or not. So I wanted to look at reality. This is reality. Is it likely to be a problem? I think the shape of these curves says no. No, I didn't go into the theory. I mean, one might. I'm not... I'd have to think about whether it's worth doing that. I mean, it could be just interesting. I mean, it certainly could be fun. But I mean, I'm not sure. Do you have something specific in mind, like what you would get out of it, or
no?
Just
to make sure that.
I mean, it is right. It's these are real sequence genomes. So.
Also, there is the question of differences. You said polymorphisms, but within an individual, there are many sequences, right? It's more profound polymorphism than you see in a diploid genome, because you have many copies and some of them are different. Is that correct?
For the most part, there's not what we would call heteroplasmy within an individual. So that's saying that there's differences within the genome. Heteroplasmy does exist, particularly there's heteroplasmy for certain diseases. These are taken from the data bank. Okay, so that means these are taken from, you know, one particular individual of this particular species and sequenced. And so this is just an example from that species. There's going to be some polymorphism, some differences within those. I was just looking at the different, what I was talking about, that distribution up to 15, that's the stretches of identical segments within the same genome. Okay, so this doesn't really have much to do with polymorphism within a population or within an individual. Yeah.
How many mitochondria did we get from our mother?
10 to the 6th, or I don't know. I don't know right off the top of my head, but it's a lot.
It's
10 to the 4th, maybe. Does anybody know that?
I thought it was more like 100.
Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
So certainly you get fewer from your father.
He gets only one cell from his mother, right? So.
Well, you can have thousands of mitochondria
in a cell,
yeah. I'm making that up. I know it's bigger, it's 100 or more, and it's probably less than 20 billion, so.
So it's interesting that there isn't polymorphism within an individual, that it's not an infinitely small bottleneck.
Well, you also got a lot of selection going on. I mean, one of the things about mitochondria is they're extremely, you get mutations and they cause disease. There's, they're probably a main cause of aging. I mean, you have errors in these things. That tends to mean that you have leaking of oxygen radicals, which causes damage to proteins in the mitochondria, which causes more leaking of oxygen radicals, which causes damage to everything else, which causes you to start to break down and age and make your knee sore after you play soccer at ITP picnic. Yes. Okay. Continue for a little bit of this morning. What? Some cool more, a few more. Why don't I just wrap this up and then leave it for Bill? But there's just a few more cool pictures. The point to say, you know, by looking at these, what can we actually find out about human proteins and evolutionary processes that can give us predictions about things of medical interest to humans? In terms of functional genomics, how well can we do better at reconstructing this sort of phylogeny as we add more taxa? Usually I throw this up, and there's a lot of biologists in the audience, and everybody can have fun picking apart what's wrong with this phylogeny. It's actually quite bad. This is what you'll find is a lot of the time people will build these phylogenies and they'll sample from the available genomes in order to get the interesting the one interesting result that they want to, and get rid of the ones that don't have interesting results that make no sense. The most interesting thing about this, actually, you can't really read this, but it's actually showing a clustering of the lamprey and the snakes, which is counter to most biologists' intuitive clustering. And yet somehow it makes a great deal of sense to a theoretical. What's that?
They look similar.
Yes, they're long, skinny things. Yes. It's a long, skinny things cluster, despite what everybody else says. This has to do with feasibility. This is just to show some slides. I'm going to blow past this, but just to show that this is actually the amount of sequencing we're talking about is well within the capacity of sequencing existing, and really a fraction of the effort involved in the Human Genome Project. In fact, I mean, I've been talking with different people like Hillis and things, and talking about the idea that pretty soon we can talk about the complete sequencing of the mitochondrial genomes of every vertebrate available, which is probably on the order of 50 to 100,000 sequences, which would be kind of cool. This is just some stuff about next steps and whatever. Basically, we're implementing this in my lab. We're extracting, purifying a bunch of genomes, sequencing them, and seeing how it goes, and seeing how we can work with the automation to speed these processes up and make it more efficient. This is to thank a bunch of collaborators who have been providing DNA samples, etc. And here's the last guessing game. Paul?
Are we in here on the Carlson? Is that a Carlson?
Yeah. No, that was a king snake, actually. Sorry. Anybody? No. The toad. Anyway, but it's a beautiful shot. I just thought that was nice. I liked the end of that one. Okay, thanks a lot. That's it.